this turning of Gaza into a human abattoir is coming to an end, even by those who felt it was necessary. But at least, thank God, it's coming to an end. Instead, they turned against Netanyahu for ending it. Netanyahu, of all people, and the military. So in light of that, how can anyone say, no, it'll never happen again?
Henry Siegman, former executive director of the American Jewish Congress. His father was a leader of the European Zionist movement, pushing for the creation of a Jewish state. Henry Siegman now serves as president of the U.S. Middle East Project. Amy Goodman sat down with him in late May. And that does it for the show. Amy Goodman will be back on the show tomorrow. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez, Hani Masood, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, worldwide at KBOO.FM. The time is 5 o'clock. It's time for the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Rising Film Festival, August 14th and 15th at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. The Portland Rising Film Festival will spotlight animation, transmedia, feature-length, and short films to highlight the wide range of new media content. Films include Sid Yiddish, The Girl Who Loved Animals, The Shattered Mind, and more. There will also be workshops and presentations to educate and entertain on the art and science of filmmaking. Again, that's the Portland Rising Film Festival, August 14th and 15th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Festicide, a three-day anti-festival taking place in venues all over Portland on August 21st through 23rd. Festicide celebrates Portland's DIY culture with an emphasis on punk, metal, and extreme music. There will be 9 shows across town over the three-day weekend with performances by Danova, Uncool Niece, Jenny Doe and the Spurs, Rabbits, The Woolen Men, VX Gas Attack, and many, many more. Again, that's Festicide, August 21st through 23rd, at venues all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown has given control of the rapidly growing Cornet Fire in Baker County over to the Oregon Fire Marshal.
An appeals court has ruled in favor of a gay couple who were denied a wedding cake by a bakery in Lakewood, Colorado.
And Washington State is being fined $100,000 per day by the state Supreme Court for failing to provide for adequate public education.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 13th, 2015. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. Authorities in St. Louis County have extended a state of emergency in Ferguson, Missouri for 24 hours. The decision came after police shot and injured a man during protests on Sunday night. Residents were commemorating 1 year since Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, was shot and killed by a white police officer.
Wildfires continue to cause alarm across the state of Oregon, resulting in closures of roads and recreation areas across the state. Most drastically, today, Governor Kate Brown invoked the Conflagration Act to help combat the Cornet Fire in Baker County in southeastern Oregon, which grew rapidly over the past day and now threatens around 170 structures. The Oregon Fire Marshal took control of the firefighting efforts this morning, right on the heels of top federal fire officials increasing fire preparedness in the West to its highest possible level, meaning all available firefighting resources are committed to fighting wildfires. In Oregon alone, 12 fires are burning over more than 100,000 acres, and 4,200 people are actively fighting them. U.S. Route 26 has been closed east of Mount Hood to Warm Springs due to the County Line 2 fire, and drivers between Portland and Bend are encouraged to take Interstate 5 from Portland to Salem and Oregon 22 from Salem to Bend. Yesterday, the federal government shut down several trails and recreation areas in the Umpqua National Forest near Crater Lake, and the Oregon Department of Transportation closed 12 miles of Oregon 230 in the northwest corner of the national park. Wildfires can shift, grow, and dissipate rapidly, so travelers and residents of affected areas are encouraged to check for updates regularly.
The town of Banks, Oregon, located in western Washington County, northwest of Hillsboro, recently implemented water use restrictions on businesses, partly in response to drought conditions across the state. For more on Oregon's driest year in decades and local responses to it, KBOO's Sam Bowman has this report.
Banks is a town of around 1,800 people nestled in the foothills of the Coast Range. The area has not been hit especially hard by the drought conditions that have descended over most of the state, but the city government recently decided to restrict water use by businesses in an effort to avoid having to restrict residential use. According to City Manager Jolyn Becker, the decision wasn't based entirely on lack of water.
The reason is that we had some facility maintenance that we had to do in the last couple of weeks, so we had to take offline one of our the sand filters, which is another source of water coming into town, and it takes several days for it to recover. And so with the hot weather and the increase in the usage of water needs, that created all the source coming from our well. So we were this way we could get our sources back to a normal level. It's a combination of both, because we're still keeping an eye on with the usage and the amount of water being needed for the summer with the drought too.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Drought Monitor has declared that 100% of the state of Oregon is experiencing a severe drought, and 50%, mostly in southeastern Oregon and the southern coast, is experiencing an extreme drought. These designations are based on broad regional conditions and don't necessarily apply at the local level. Thus, while the northwest corner of the state is technically in a drought, officials are not particularly worried about having to restrict water use for the rest of the year. According to Tacy Steele, water program coordinator for the city of Hillsboro, the month of June was the most alarming for the region around Portland due to several days with temperatures over 90 degrees and minimal to no rainfall. However, July has seen more typical summer weather, and Steele says the Hillsboro water supply is holding steady at about 55% capacity. The Portland Water Bureau also told KBOO that Portland's water supply is generally not affected by the statewide water shortage, and reservoirs are at about 40%. At the state level, responses to the unfolding crisis vary. According to Diana Enright, a water policy analyst with the Oregon Water Resources Department, it's up to counties to request emergency drought declarations from the governor.
Once a county has asked for an emergency drought declaration from the governor, then what it does is it frees up some tools that the Water Resources Department has for those who have water rights. And so that allows those with water rights to apply for some temporary emergency permits.
Currently, 23 of Oregon's 36 counties have had drought emergencies declared by Governor Kate Brown. Water use rights vary significantly from county to county, however, as Enright explains.
Well, water rights are based on first in time, first in line. So how we regulate water is by when the water right was issued. So there are parts of the state where we are regulating for senior water rights that predate statehood for Oregon. So back to 1858, which means that we, for irrigation water, we regulate off the junior water rights holders for the senior holder.
This past winter's snowpack was the lowest in 35 years, raising troubling questions about the years to come.
Well, it's the coming years that we're most concerned about, because it's, you know, impossible to predict what will be coming. But when you look at what the Natural Resources Conservation Service has said, that 2015 is liable to be one for the history books. The state snowpack that we had was so low that it broke previous low snow years of 1977, 1981, 1992, and 2005. And the other concern for the NRCS is that they are seeing soil moisture in the mountains and foothills at new low levels, something they've never seen since they've been keeping records. And the Department of Water, the Water Resources Department is seeing stream flows that are at near or record low levels.
That was Diana Enright, Water Policy Analyst with the Oregon Water Resources Department. The U.S. Drought Monitor's reports, released every Thursday, can be found on their website at www.oregon.gov/ORD. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
The U.S. Coast Guard has issued fines of $5,000 each for five Greenpeace protesters who tried to stop a Shell Oil icebreaker from leaving Portland on July 29th. The activists dangled off the St. John's Bridge and blocked the ship for nearly 40 hours. The ship eventually made its way back to the Arctic Ocean to drill for oil after protesters were brought up by police. Greenpeace can appeal the Coast Guard's decision in Virginia.
A campaign rally for Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush in Las Vegas yesterday ended early after Black Lives Matter protesters interrupted the event. Several activists with Black Lives Matter also met with Governor Bush before the event. When protesters asked him to connect race and justice, he said, "We have serious problems. People no longer trust the basic institutions in our society that they need to trust to create, to make things work." Protesters continued to chant as the event came to an end. According to Think Progress, other people at the event responded to the protesters by chanting "White Lives Matter" and "All Lives Matter."
A Colorado Court of Appeals ruled today that a Lakewood, Colorado bakery violated that state's Anti-Discrimination Act when it refused to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex marriage. Charles Craig and David Mullins went to the Masterpiece Cake Shop in 2012 to order a cake for their wedding. The owner, Jack Phillips, refused their order, claiming that it violated his Christian beliefs and that making the cake would violate his religious freedom as well as his right to free speech. Also, same-sex marriage was not yet legally recognized in Colorado at the time. Same-sex marriage has only been legal in Colorado since October of 2014. The couple planned to have their marriage ceremony in Massachusetts, where same-sex marriage was then legal, and later have a celebration, complete with wedding cake, with friends in Colorado. A state administrative law judge and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had both previously ruled in favor of the couple and against the bakery. Attorneys for the defendants say they may appeal the decision. If they do appeal, the case would go first to the Colorado Supreme Court before it could go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
A county clerk's office in Kentucky is defying a federal court order to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Rowan County Clerk Kim Davis stopped issuing marriage licenses to any couple, straight or gay, after the Supreme Court ruled in June that same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry. Davis had even been ordered by Kentucky Governor Stephen Beshear to begin issuing marriage licenses. The ACLU filed a lawsuit on behalf of four couples, two of them heterosexual, to force Davis to begin issuing marriage licenses again. U.S. District Court Judge David L. Bunning ruled in the ACLU's favor on Wednesday and ordered Ms. Davis to begin issuing marriage licenses. Davis immediately filed an appeal and is seeking a stay. She is also suing the governor of Kentucky over his order. This morning, Ms. Davis failed to go to work. Her deputies informed a couple who were there to get a marriage license that none would be issued today. Ms. Davis is one of two county clerks in Kentucky out of a total of 120 in the state who are defying Governor Beshear's order to issue marriage licenses. Judge Bunning ruled Davis is, quote, free to believe that marriage is a union between a man and a woman, as many Americans do. However, her religious convictions cannot excuse her from performing the duties that she took an oath to perform as Rowan County Clerk.
Petitioners trying to recall State Senator Floyd Prezansky may have violated Oregon election law. The Oregon Democracy Fund filed a complaint with the Secretary of State's office yesterday. The complaint says that members of the campaign and employees of gun stores did not follow specific rules for filing a recall petition. The recall campaign is one of several that were filed across the state after Oregon adopted criminal background checks for gun purchases made over the internet. KABU reporter Alan Montecillo spoke with Angela Martin with the Oregon Democracy Fund to learn more.
Oregon law is very clear when it comes to circulating a petition for either a ballot measure or a recall. It states that if an individual is being paid as part of their job to circulate a petition and get signatures from a voter, they need to register with the Secretary of State and go through training before they start collecting voters' personal information. That did not happen in multiple instances that are cited in this complaint.
Did they register with the Secretary of State at all, or did they? Was there just a gap in time between when they started collecting and when they registered?
No, the gun stores and the employees in those gun stores. We have multiple instances where those employees who are paid individuals never registered to circulate the petition.
The sort of second piece of the law that you say has been violated includes leaving recall petitions unattended, which violates Oregon law that clearly states a circulator must, quote, personally witness each signature collected. Tell me what that means. Does that mean that petitioners just left, in a literal sense, they just left recall petitions out there? Tell me a bit more about what leaving it unattended means.
Right. Again, Oregon law has these provisions in order to protect the identity of the voters who are signing the petitions and to protect the initiative process from fraud and abuse. So one of the provisions is you must actually witness the signatures and not just be in the presence of the petition. At least two gun stores were found circulating the petition without any supervision. The petition itself was left on the counter. The employee who was circulating it walking about and not being able to have their eyes on it is the allegation here.
Could you tell me a bit more about the pieces of evidence that you've brought to support this complaint?
The complaint that was filed includes multiple instances of our volunteers and monitors witnessing the violations firsthand.
Why do you think these laws weren't followed? Are the petitioners just being lazy and forgetting to follow procedure? I mean, what's the
recall
behind this?
Process is clearly explained to the chief petitioner. There's a manual that the chief petitioner is presented with when they file to circulate a petition, either a ballot measure or a recall. Not following it is simply, shows a real disregard and respect for the law itself. It's clear. It's made clear. The chief petitioner is put on notice that it is their duty to make sure that not only they follow the law, but that their paid signature gatherers and their volunteers must also follow the law. So clearly the gun lobby extremists behind this reckless recall effort simply have no respect for the law itself.
And there have been other recall efforts once the background checks law was passed against Representative Val Hoyle, Representative McLean, and Senator Chuck Riley. Could you tell me a bit more about other recall campaigns that similar recall petitions have been filed around the state?
Right. Well, the Senator Prezansky's recall is similar to what we saw against Representative Val Hoyle, Representative Susan McLean, and Senator Chuck Riley. They were all threatened with a recall in retaliation for their leadership on a gun safety bill, closing a loophole in Oregon's law that allowed criminals and other dangerous people to bypass the criminal background check by simply shopping for a gun online. These extremists, in retaliation for that vote, filed recall efforts. Now, they dropped those efforts in three of the campaigns, Representative Hoyle, McLean, and Senator Riley. But it is ongoing in Senator Przanski's district.
Why did the previous petitioners drop their campaigns?
The signature deadline approached. They didn't turn the signatures in. I'll leave it to the campaigns to explain why they failed to submit signatures.
That was Angela Martin with the Oregon Democracy Fund. I'm Alan Montecelio with KBOO News.
Washington State is being fined $100,000 per day because it is failing to adequately provide for public education. The Washington Supreme Court found in 2012 that the state was failing in its constitutional responsibility to provide for public education. The court decided in the case of McLeary versus State to allow the legislature to come up with and fund a plan to solve the education problem. The regular legislative session in Washington State ended in April this year. Then the legislature reconvened for three short special sessions, finally bringing their term to a close on July 10th. Unfortunately, the state had still not come up with a working plan to fix its educational system. The justices found the state in contempt of court last fall and has now ordered the state of Washington to pay $100,000 per day for each day it remains in violation of the court's orders. Governor Inslee had stated that he will meet with legislative leaders next week to figure out a plan for dealing with education and may call for yet another special session this year. The next regular session of the Washington legislature is scheduled to begin on January 11th.
Nearly a dozen cities and counties in Oregon have taken steps to ban marijuana businesses. The list includes Douglas, Umatilla, Harney, and Malheur counties. This comes as the state of Oregon gets ready to allow legal retail sales through medical dispensaries beginning October 1st as part of marijuana legalization. Measure 91 allows local authorities to ban marijuana businesses, but adults will still be able to use and grow marijuana in those areas.
Federal charges have been filed against a labor organizer in California who has been heading up efforts to unionize the medical cannabis industry. Dan Rush was the director of the Cannabis Workers Rising campaign for the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union until this morning. The U.S. Justice Department has indicted Rush on charges that he accepted kickbacks and at least $600,000 in bribes, helped to rig union votes in favor of dispensary owners, and engaged in other illegal activities. Rush was appointed head of the union's cannabis division in 2011. The investigation seems to have begun sometime in 2012, according to the affidavit filed by an FBI agent. Rush's own attorney, Mark Terbeek, became an FBI informant in the investigation at the beginning of this year, after his office was raided by the feds. The UFCW is one of the unions doing organizing work in Oregon's new cannabis industry.
This weekend, more than 100,000 people a day are expected to gather along the Seattle waterfront for the annual HempFest marijuana legalization rally and concert. HempFest is billed as the world's largest marijuana legalization protestival. KBOO spoke with Vivian McPeak, director of Seattle HempFest, to find out more.
Well, Seattle HempFest is, as you mentioned, the world's largest cannabis policy reform event in its 24th year. Here in about a week and a half, we're going to have roughly 150 to 200,000 people, everybody's guessed exactly how many, down on the Seattle waterfront for 1.5 miles of expanse with six stages, 140 bands, over 100 speakers, a huge hemposium circus tent with panel discussions and keynote presentations, stuff like that, and about 400 arts, crafts, food, and informational vendors. And we're going to hemp present all day long for 3 days.
I'm wondering now, it takes a lot of people to run HempFest on the day, well, I guess on the weekend. How many volunteers do you have working at the fest, altogether or at any one time?
Well, we print 1,000 staff shirts for HempFest, and we usually run out. So we have at least 1,000 people working for HempFest, filling 128 crews and 125 crew coordinators. We got the 125 people are our core group, and they meet all year round, every month. And then we have a 9-person board of directors. So we have well over 1,000 people that are going to work on the event to make it happen.
Some people out there might be thinking, why keep doing a protestival like HempFest? There are four states with legal marijuana. Everyone and their cousins are putting on marijuana trade and business shows. What would you say about all that?
Well, you know, the first thing I'd say, Doug, is that, of course, cannabis is still illegal on the federal level. It's still a Schedule I substance. So it really, from a legal perspective, there is no state with legal marijuana. It's all kind of smoke and mirrors. If you're the federal government, it could be shut down at any time. President Trump or President Clinton or President Bush coming in, whoever the next president is, could kind of put the kibosh on the whole thing. But I can even go more fundamental than that and say that here in my state, Washington, which is one of the first two states to, quote, legalize, there's some folks called the Kettle Falls Five, and they were growing a state legal medical marijuana grow, and four of them right now are facing 20 years in federal penitentiary because they've been federally prosecuted. There's still about 50 Americans serving lifetime sentences for marijuana. And while we're doing this interview today, somebody in America has those red lights behind their car right now, where their door's being bashed in and they're going to lose their career and their home maybe, and they're break up their family and lose their freedom. So, you know, until the last person's let out of jail or marijuana is completely descheduled entirely like alcohol and tobacco from the federal schedule, we think that it's time to keep fighting and fighting strong.
That was Vivian McPeak, director of Seattle HempFest, speaking with me about HempFest and the marijuana laws in Washington state. HempFest takes place tomorrow through Sunday along the Seattle waterfront.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in Depth. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy with a chance of thunderstorms, with a high of 71 and a low of 57. Today in history, in 1964, the last victims of capital punishment in the United Kingdom were executed. In 1960, the Central African Republic became free of French rule. And in 1898, Spanish and American forces staged a mock battle for the Filipino city of Manila in order to keep it from falling under control of the native Filipinos. The U.S. shortly annexed the Philippines, and the Filipino-American War began shortly after. The quote of the day is from James Baldwin. "It is certain that ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have."
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Who does David Keating think he's fooling? He heads an obscure corporate-funded group pushing to wipe out the few remaining limits on the special interests that put extremely big bucks into political campaigns. "It's only fair to turn the fat cat donors loose," he explains, "because an unlimited infusion of cash from, say, the Koch brothers would instantly make an unknown candidate competitive. After all," Keating adds, "most startup operations need an angel investor, someone who believes in the project and puts money in to make it viable." Ah, yes, a devilish new twist on the old cash and carry business model. Our cash can carry you into office to help us. But a run for public office should not be thought of as a corporate startup and ought to be made viable not by the special interest money it attracts, but by the ability of its ideas and principles to draw public support. Also, while a corporate campaign donor clearly does see itself as an investor hoping to profit from the project, there's nothing angelic about it. Acknowledging that presidential, congressional, and many gubernatorial campaigns are now financed and even run by a small band of deep-pocketed elites, Keating says ordinary folks needn't worry, for this top-heavy system really doesn't mean that the officials it elects will put their patrons' interests over the public's. Really? Well, he admits, while those who paid for the election will naturally get their phone calls returned by officials they put in office, quote, "I don't think it's going to drive policy." This is Jim Hightower saying, "Really? Golly, little Nelly Sunshine, then why do you think the moneyed interests would bother calling? Just to chat with a corruptible politico or to collect on their investment?" Even Keating must know that these donors are not buying a phone call. They're buying public policy. Really.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
Illinois, like many other states, is seeing an increase in the use of heroin and other opiates. A new report by the Illinois Consortium on Drug Policy finds that at the same time, the state is also cutting back drastically on funding for treatment. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with the consortium's executive director, Kathleen Kane Willis, of Roosevelt University in Chicago, to find out more.
We found that the heroin crisis is basically remaining at the extreme elevated levels that we've seen for the last more than 5 years, I would say. It's actually getting worse downstate. And at the same time, treatment capacity fell by more than 50%. So in 2007, we ranked 28th in the nation in treatment capacity. But in 2012, we had fallen to the third worst in the nation, just above Tennessee and Texas.
And this is in spite of data showing year after year that we've been seeing, pointing out the escalation in use of opiate painkillers and also the growing availability of very, very strong heroin, oftentimes, some places at least, being cut with the very powerful opiate fentanyl.
Yes. In fact, in Illinois, we do see fentanyl in the heroin pretty commonly. I think it's the new normal, actually. I think that's my suspicion. It's that when you think about drug trafficking, it's much easier to bring in something that's so much smaller and more powerful, because fentanyl is 100 times more powerful than heroin or morphine. And so if you're going to smuggle something in, it makes sense to put fentanyl in the heroin, because the potency would be high and the quantity you would need would be much smaller. So it makes sense from a trafficking perspective that would be the way that things are going, not just in Illinois, but across the nation.
Well, now, give me some of the numbers.
Well, one of the issues that we have in Illinois is the fact, so there's state-funded treatment, and that's funded by general revenue dollars with matching grants from the feds. In Illinois, because we've had such a dire fiscal situation, and there have been a lot of cuts to treatment in terms of funding, but the cuts to treatment funding, which it's about 30%, of general revenue funding has been cut, although this next year it's going to be cut even further. It's going to be like a 61% decrease since 2007. But that's not the whole picture. People don't understand that the uncertainty of funding, meaning there would be a cut to funding and then maybe it would be reinstated a couple months later. That kind of uncertainty in funding human services means that the availability of treatment goes down too at a much higher rate than actually the dollars in and dollars out. It's not so simple as that, because a treatment facility, for example, if they don't have funding, it's not as though they can take in folks and then the next month take in double the number if they get the funding restored. Do you understand what I mean? So, you know, that when there's a cut made, and even if it's partially restored later down the road, the capacity is diminished even if that funding is restored, because you can't, it's not like you can double the number of beds or double the number of treatment slots. So that's the situation that we have in Illinois. And then on the Medicaid side, we have a serious problem, because medication-assisted treatment is not funded in Illinois. Methadone is totally not funded under Medicaid, not at all, zero. The only way you can get methadone is under state-funded treatment facilities, which have been, the capacity has dropped by more than 50%. So we've got that issue. And then buprenorphine, we have the most restrictive time limits for buprenorphine, lifetime limits in the nation. The longest you can get buprenorphine treatment is 1 year. And so Illinois is arguably having one of the, you know, it's one of the worst states in terms of this issue, the heroin and opiate issue. And then we don't have the medications to be able to treat people with Medicaid. And then we have that huge decrease in funding, which brings us, and this is shameful for Illinois, just above Texas and Tennessee is the worst in the nation. So that's in a nutshell, basically the finding of the report. And, you know, one of the things that we did look at downstate Illinois, and for people who aren't familiar with downstate Illinois from a Chicago perspective, that's anything south of Chicago metro area. The increase in places like Decatur, which are very rural, you know, it is really staggering in terms of people entering treatment for heroin. In 2012, that's the last year that data was available for comparison with all of the states. We hit a new high in terms of the number of people, the percentage of people entering treatment for heroin. It went up to 16% of all treatment admissions across the nation were for heroin. That's the highest level since data collection began in 1992. In Illinois, one out of four people enters, 25% of people enter treatment for heroin of all publicly funded treatment. So it's significantly higher. In the Chicago metro area, it's 35% are entering treatment. So you can see there's an absolute need, and at the same time, a giant decline in treatment capacity.
That was Kathleen Kane Willis, director of the Illinois Consortium on Drug Policy, speaking with KABU reporter Doug McVeigh about their new report on the heroin crisis in Illinois.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis says Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner's assertions that the teachers union is so powerful it dictates terms and his threats to remove pensions from collective bargaining is crazy talk.
That it's crazy. That's just crazy talk. It has no meaning. If we're so empowered, then why are our members getting laid off? If we're so powerful, then why aren't we in charge of how you put stuff together? Why are we still struggling and suffering under an appointed school board when every other district in this state has an elected school board?
Lewis's comments came on Chicago Public TV. She says if Chicago schools try to impose a 7% pay cut by forcing teachers to pay 7% more into their pensions, it would be strike-worthy. She says the real problem is revenue. With the district facing a nearly $500 million budget hole, even if teachers pay the extra 7% into pensions, the real financial problem, she says, still won't be solved.
We need to look at the revenue piece because that's what's wrong here. You can't make up $500 million with the teachers union having people pay into the pension fund at 7% instead of 2%.
Lewis says school will start on time September 8th in Chicago. If there's a strike, it's not likely to happen before the first of the year. Four New Jersey unions are suing Governor Chris Christie to contest his imposition of a pay freeze on state workers. New Jersey Communications Workers of America, New Jersey Superior Officers Association, Fraternal Order of Police Local 174, and the Law Enforcement Unit are all challenging Christie's suspension of automatic step pay increases for state workers. Past practice was to continue those increases even if no new labor contracts have been reached. The suit alleges that the Governor's Office of Employee Relations has no authority to stop those step pay raises. The unions say only New Jersey's Civil Service Commission can legally make changes to state worker compensation. Republicans on the U.S. Senate's Finance Committee are trying to prohibit labor unions for IRS workers. The National Treasury Employees Union represents 85,000 workers, 46,000 of them at the IRS. The proposal to ban unions at the IRS tried to justify the action by saying that the nature of their work requires them to be completely apolitical. The Republican attack on the NTEU went on to say that a substantial number of IRS employees are members of the, quote, highly partisan and left-leaning National Treasury Employees Union, end quote. Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee defended federal worker unions, saying that union membership in and of itself does not mean political bias. NTEU says no bipartisan report has ever found any evidence of political motivation on the part of IRS employees.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Connecticut Supreme Court has extended that state's ban on the death penalty. However, their decision may open the door for state lawmakers to roll back the ban, which was originally decreed in 2012. For more, we go to reporter Melinda Tuhus with our friends at Free Speech Radio News.
Connecticut had already repealed the death penalty, but had grandfathered in those people already on death row. Thursday's ruling holds that the Connecticut Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment forbids the state from executing any prisoners at all. David McGuire, legislative and policy director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Connecticut, hailed the court's decision.
The really significant point that the majority made in the decision was that the death penalty is so badly flawed. They talked about the racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic biases in the death penalty process itself, which is a problem that we and other advocates have pointed out for a very, very long time. So this decision is very, very meaningful in that it makes clear that the death penalty falls below American standards of justice.
In 2009, Connecticut lawmakers passed a total repeal, but it was vetoed by the then Republican governor. When anti-death penalty legislators tried again in 2012, their efforts were stymied by two pending death sentences for men who had clearly committed a brutal crime that had shaken the state. The compromise was an abolition bill that was not retroactive and would only apply to future convictions. The measure passed and was signed by the Democratic governor. Gary Winfield was a state representative from New Haven at the time and the leader of the abolition fight.
So the compromise was in order to, get towards the bigger picture, which is that the death penalty needed, from my perspective, to go away. We never would have gotten it done without leaving the two individuals who committed the Cheshire crime on death row. People felt like they needed to be executed. And so it's politics. Sometimes you have to give a little in order to get access to the bigger picture, and that's what we did.
Since this court decision does exactly what abolition opponents predicted, Winfield, now a state senator, said the whole issue could be raised again, with opponents using the Supreme Court ruling as a platform from which to launch their efforts to reinstate the death penalty. Four other states have prospective bans on capital punishment, meaning their existing death row prisoners still face the death penalty. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
An explosion in the northern Chinese city of Tianjin has killed more than 50 people and injured more than 500 others late last night. More than 3,500 people are now in temporary shelters. Officials have not confirmed the cause of the blast, but the Chinese army has sent 200 chemical experts to the city in order to test the air for toxic gases. Local residents also report chemical odors in the surrounding area. Tianjin is located just 30 minutes from Beijing by train, and rescue efforts are still underway.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, August 13th, 2015. Two youth injured, another 12 kidnapped as Israeli soldiers invade West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinian youth were injured and 12 others were kidnapped by Israeli troops on Thursday during Israeli army invasions targeting West Bank communities. According to medical sources, two youth sustained moderate injuries during clashes that erupted with invading troops at the town of Ad-Doha near Bethlehem City. Both were moved to Bethlehem City Hospital for treatment. Invasions and kidnappings were also reported in Ramallah City, Hebron, Jenin, and Nablus, local sources reported. Moreover, Israeli soldiers demolished on Thursday a Palestinian home under construction after invading the village of Taqwa near Bethlehem. According to local sources, soldiers said that the house was built without needed permission. The Israeli army never gives permissions to Palestinians in areas it controls to build homes. In other news, a group of Israeli settlers firebombed a Bedouin tent on the outskirts of Kfar Malik village near Ramallah city in central West Bank. Residents were able to extinguish the fire before anyone was hurt. The settlers fled the scene after writing racist graffiti on walls, such as "Death to Palestinians" and "Price Tag." On Wednesday, settlers attacked and injured a Palestinian worker in Jerusalem. In related news, Israeli medical sources said that the mother of 18-month-old Palestinian boy who was killed in recent arson settler attack on his home in the occupied West Bank may have gone brain dead. According to doctors, Rahima Dawabsha was put on a respirator earlier this week, with some doctors at the Israeli hospital she is in suggesting she may be brain dead. On July 31st, a group of settlers attacked Dawabsha house with firebombs. As a result, her 18-month-old baby was killed instantly while her husband died on Saturday. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, August 13th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Doug McVeigh and Alan Montecelio. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron White.